When we look at the way that Donald Trump has decided to somehow get along or make a deal with Yemen, and right now they're talking about Hamas and his visit to the Middle East, he's not going to visit Israel. And Pete Hegseth, he planned to go to Israel, but he canceled that plan. He said that later on, I may go to Israel. It seems that whatever is happening that we're not aware of is something under the surface that is happening, that somehow some sort of tensions between the two administrations. But is this tension coming from the Netanyahu's decision because Donald Trump is not happy? We know that he's willing to put an end to any conflict as soon as possible in his mind, but it's not in the mind of Netanyahu. That's not possible. That's why they're not getting along.
Hey, if you can put a musical track to your show, we get the appropriate music here. We get the Hollies. Something's happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. That would be a great song to put under this. I think maybe part of the impetus was the shellacking that the United States took in Yemen. Trump and his team, were sitting around, yeah, man, we're gonna show those Yemenis who's a tough guy. We're not a bunch of wimps like Biden and his crew. By God, they just haven't been hit hard enough. And so, we're great. We get back in the business of killing civilians. And we blow up a bunch of civilian sites. And yet the Houthis, instead of shooting down one Predator drone a month, now start shooting down one a week. And then on top of it, by the end of the fiasco, the U.S. has lost at least three FA-18 Hornets at $70, $80 million a pop. So there's $250,000 between those three aircraft alone. And then when you add in the 15 drones lost during the Biden administration, plus seven more drones lost during the Trump administration, that's 22. You come up with a, basically about $1 billion worth of lost equipment. And so I think it was that frustration realizing, okay, this ain't working. And we got an escape route. This Sultan of Oman seems to be the key player, and he's a key player in getting the United States and Iran to talk and mediating that. I'm sure he's got the full support of Russia and China, and he's able to convince the United States that, look, you're going to come visit the Saudis. The Saudis, frankly, you're going to get a pretty frosty reception unless you can stop killing these Houthis. Which is, the irony there is, go back 2 years, 3 years, the Houthis and the Saudis were at each other's throat. And so the Saudis have done a complete volte-face, reversal, turnabout in this regard, plus solidifying, cementing a new era of relationship with Iran. So I think, you take all of that together. There was a recognition at the Trump White House that if they want to have any kind of success, they're gonna have to change what they're doing. And part of that change is, now I'm not sure what we call it, lessening support for Israel, but at least not appearing in public to be, kissing Israel's rear end at every opportunity.
Yeah, one of the things that I do believe that the Trump administration is considering right now is how the reality of the Middle East has changed with the new sort of relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia. In that clip that Netanyahu was talking, and you see the way that he's picturing the Middle East, saying that the Arab states are getting closer to us and Iran is the enemy. It seems that it's totally the opposite way,
Yeah,
right?
absolutely the opposite. Well, look, this is—it's this is still, I would argue, a consequence of the special military operation in Ukraine, the attempt to isolate and destroy Russia, at the same time that the West was increasing its harsh rhetoric directed at China as an enemy, as a military power that must be conquered. When you brought Russia and China together into that partnership, and then they accelerated the development of BRICS as an alternative financial power in the world economy, where nations no longer were going to be held hostage by the U.S. dollar, that started a change, and it's been like a chain reaction. Because Iran has been brought into BRICS. So just from an economic standpoint, Iran's actually in a better position now than it was 10 years ago when they were pressured into the JCPOA, that Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And other nations in the global south are, this is like a international version of the movie Broadcast, where people are throwing their windows open and yelling, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." And that's what they're, there's a growing unity. A lot of U.S. policy over the last, 70 years has been, let's call it a divide and conquer, promote conflict. If you think about it, the reason Nixon went to China was not because we loved the Chinese. They were just a tool to be used to go after Russia. When Iran and Iraq, when Iran, the Ayatollah, took over in 1979, then the United States set about provoking the war, encouraging the attack of Iraq on Iran. And at the same time, it was even stranger, is the United States was also providing some military aid to Iran. All we wanted was to see that the Iraqis and Iranians kill each other. God bless, man. The more of those Middle Eastern, trash that we can kill, the better. I mean, you see how cynical, how evil this is. And then, with respect to the Houthis and the Saudis, we wanted to provoke that war in order to go after Iran. So much, and then we're back to Ukraine and Russia, provoked by the United States. I love the concept of what my country was supposed to be, really dedicated to freedom and to liberty, and yet born out of depriving, Native Americans of their land, and born in part with a legacy of slavery. Despite those evils, there was still at heart a concept of America being something better and different. But now we look at what it's become in the post-World War II era, and we're like a goddamn arsonist. We're running around setting fires and then, going in offering to sell fire insurance. So it's not just an isolated instance. So when we look at what's taking place now, I think there's a realization, maybe even a fear in Washington, that it's lost control of the narrative. That with Iran and the Saudis now pledging support to each other in some very, unprecedented ways. And with China and Russia flexing their muscle as well. And particularly this new relationship, comprehensive security agreement that Russia signed with Iran. I think Trump and company are playing catch up. In fact, I don't even think they fully appreciate how profound these changes are. We are in the early stages of the birth of a new world order. Whether it will usher in peace and prosperity for those who have been exploited for so many years, a whole nother question. But the ability of the United States to dictate and control, I think, is it's coming undone.
Larry, we had the fourth round of talks between Iran and the United States. Both said that it was difficult but useful. And it's the situation, the foreign minister of Iran said that the talks are getting more serious. Mm-hmm. And what's your evaluation of, what's your take on what has happened in this round of talks between the two parties?
Well, the good news is they talked again, okay? So that's there's a silver lining, and they're going to talk again. So there will be a fifth round. But now we come down to the heart of the issue. And from Iran, what Iran, I think, is willing to negotiate on is, we will surrender all nuclear enrichment programs above 3.6%. That enriched uranium at those levels will be held by Russia, and our research and medical isotopes will get from Russia. But Iran is not going to eliminate a peaceful nuclear program, nor should it have to. The United States is insisting that, oh, you got to stop it all. And while you're at it, get rid of those missiles and cut off contact with Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. If that remains the U.S. position, there will be no agreement. And then the United States is going to, you know, once again be faced with, or Trump in particular, he's made these threats. And if they dare to attack Iran, it will be the end of the Trump administration. Because he will then be embroiled in a war that he cannot win. And these pundits that populate the airwaves over here who think that we can just waltz in and crush Iran and, oh, by God, it'll be over in a week or two. And they haven't learned a damn thing from history. All these quick victories. I mean, going back to the Civil War, you had crowds of Washingtonians in carriages riding out to the Manassas battlefield. Oh, this is going to be great, man. We're going to crush the Confederacy. Didn't turn out that way. They lost that battle. Similarly, World War I was supposed to be over, in a snap of an eye, blink of an eye, I mean. Vietnam, Iraq, mission accomplished. So this is one more disaster waiting to happen if they go down that route. So I don't think Iran is not in such a desperate strait that the United States can compel them to lose their entire nuclear program. The added advantage now is Iran's got China and Russia firmly in its camp. In the 2015 JCPOA negotiations, they did not. Both Russia and China each were sort of holding them at arm's length. Not now, because I think they all recognize that the game the United States has been playing is both malicious and destructive.
Larry, there is a very substantial and important division within the Republican Party, mm-hmm. as we talk. Some of them are supporting Israel and the way that Netanyahu wants the policy of the United States to be in the Middle East, and like Lindsey Graham, Tom Cotton, Ted Cruz on Fox News,
Lindsey Graham.
And these people want to destroy Iranian nuclear program. And we know that if the talks go in that direction, Iran said this is a red line. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do that.
Right.
We're going to limit it. We're going to limit enrichment of uranium, but we're not going to destroy it. And on the other hand, we have the people like you, Colin McGregor, and even Scott Ritter, who voted for Donald Trump, but Tucker Carlson, but you don't want to be to go and make a war, make a new war in the Middle East. Here is what Colin McGregor said in terms of a direct war with Iran.
34 years ago, it was my honor and privilege to lead American soldiers to victory in battle, to witness the courage and valor of American soldiers at a time and a place when death was all around us. Fortunately, we sustained very few casualties. However, in the years that followed, I watched many of the soldiers I served with pass on, not on foreign battlefields, but on American soil, frequently forgotten by the nation they served. In one case, a major who served with me as a lieutenant in 1993 committed suicide. The memories of the friends he lost in Iraq during a pointless, self-defeating occupation after 2003 were more than he could bear. Yet who today remembers the Iraq War that began in 2003, or that the American military intervention was justified on the utterly false grounds that WMD, that is, weapons of mass destruction, were being built inside Iraq? The conflict took the lives of nearly 4,500 Americans in uniform, not including contractors, of course, and cost $2 trillion. At least 800,000 Iraqi citizens were internally displaced, and several hundred thousand Iraqi citizens lost their lives. Tonight, I break my silence, not just for the young officer that committed suicide, but for the wives, husbands, children, and parents who endured the crushing grief of loss, who received a folded flag, and were left alone to trace the name of a loved one on a cold gravestone. War is a predator. It consumes our best, our strength, and our resources, but its most terrible damage is often unseen. War also forces Americans to embrace brutality, to justify barbarism, to become something harder, colder, less humane. President Trump promised to stop the endless wars. Now he really needs to do it. Americans currently stand at what Lincoln would call the fiery trial through which we pass: war with Iran or peace for America. The choice will echo through generations. We're very fortunate. The Iranians are willing to talk to us again, and perhaps we can reach a solution. But there are no guarantees. That will take leadership from the highest levels, from President Trump. Let me speak plainly about what awaits if Washington chooses war with Iran. Within hours of the first strike, Iran will seal the Strait of Hormuz, choking the artery through which one-fifth of the world's oil flows. Gas prices will not merely rise, they may erupt like a volcano, burning through family budgets. The economic security Americans built with their own hands since the pandemic disaster could be wrecked. Immediate price increases and loss of supplies could also result. Yet the cost in treasure stands as nothing before the cost in blood. Iran is not the Iraq of our past wars. Iran consists of 85 million people, fortified by mountains when the Roman Empire was young, defended by modern weapons, and effectively allied with nuclear-armed powers, Russia and China, that have drawn clear and unambiguous red lines. For the first time since missiles stood in Cuba, we face not only the shadow, but the real substance of nuclear confrontation. Not for our country, but for the regional ambitions of a foreign state 7,000 miles from home. We must face the truth that weaker allies often attempt to make their wars our wars. The Constitution placed the power to decide for peace or war in your hands. Between now and midnight, you should contact your representatives and senators with one message: no war with Iran.
Larry, the people who know what does war mean, they just worrying about the conflict, the confrontation between Iran and the United States. And those people who are political who don't know anything about war. They're just advocating to get more aggressive toward Iran. How if you were to talk with Republicans who voted for Donald Trump, who want something for the United States, who want to get rid of the conflict in Ukraine, in the Middle East, and maybe a better future with China, how can you talk with them? What would be your main point to them?
I always try to deal with facts. You know, I applaud Doug. Let's call that his Smedley Butler moment of the 21st century. Do you know who Smedley Butler is or was?
No.
You know, so he was at the time, the most highly decorated Marine in the U.S. Marine Corps. And in the 1930s, he wrote a book, War is a Racket. And he described how he realized, looking back on his career, he had been continuously used to go wage war on unsuspecting foreigners on behalf of banking and manufacturing and agricultural interests, financial interests. And so that's part of what Doug is pointing out. What I've been trying to do repeatedly, and unfortunately I'm really such a small voice, you know, I try to, you know, build up Sonar 21 so that people will come and read and take on board the things I put out. But this one narrative, for example, that Iran is this terrible terrorist state, irredeemable, and that, you know, the facts don't back that up. But that's the narrative. It's been constructed. And Iran, by, you know, some of its language early on in the revolution, the start of the revolution back in 79 and 80, you know, contributed to help, you know, provided ammunition to the West that the CIA and British MI6 could then use effectively to paint Iran as this, you know, irredeemable terrorist state. So what I would try to do is, you know, and what I have been trying to do is put out the facts that, you know, Iran, despite the claim that Iran is the number one sponsor of terrorism, according to the U.S. State Department's own reports, which are provided from the U.S. intelligence community, for you know, the last, you know, 20 years, you've only had a couple of occasions where groups that were sponsored by Iran were put in the top 10 terrorist groups, and that was October 7th, which we can have an entirely, I do not agree that that was, quote, terrorism. There were some aspects that would be considered as terrorist attacks in terms of attacks on civilians for political purposes. But by and large, it was basically a Hamas raid on U.S., on Israeli military sites and military personnel. But that narrative, again, that narrative's blocked. So trying to break people out of these narratives is, you know, what I hope to do. But, you know, Nima, look, the reality is it's going to take some sort of disaster where the United States has, you know, acts upon its fantasies and it blows up in their face. And then only in the depths of defeat do they come to grips with, man, we got to change what we're doing. We can't keep doing this. You know, I hope it doesn't come to that, but that's my fear. That's where I think we're headed. If we continue to insist on these false narratives. And the heart of this false narrative is that we've got to generate international threats in order to keep funneling money into the military-industrial complex. I mean, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, and frankly, there are probably 1,000 more DoD contractors that are sitting there, you know, sucking on the hind tit of Uncle Sam.
Do you think that would be possible for any administration in the United States to shift the interest of these companies that you've mentioned, military industrial complex, to shift their focus on something else? I don't know. Space program and something else instead of being sending weapons, just producing weapons for the United States, but not just igniting a new war like in Ukraine or in the Middle East? Because do you see that coming to the United States?
It needs to happen, but I don't see it. I don't see it coming. Again, barring some catastrophe. Here again, I look at Trump. Oh yeah, we're going to cut the budget, and then he's boosting the defense budget up to over $1 trillion. For God's sake, it's going the wrong direction. You know, there are cuts that have to be made, but we refuse to make those cuts. And part of it is there's so much institutional interest tied up in this. Our system is corrupted. It's corrupt. And it's going to kill itself.
Yeah. Larry, the conflict in Ukraine and Donald Trump, it seems that Russia is going to talk with Ukrainians in Istanbul. How much of a deal is that? How much of a change is that?
Well, Ukraine's not going to talk to Russia. Until, you know, Zelensky issued a decree in September 2022, maybe it was October, I don't recall the precise date, making it illegal, a criminal act for any Ukrainian to talk to the Russians. So let's see what happens today, so it's already 6 p.m. In Kiev and in Russia, in Moscow. Has Zelensky reversed that decree? You know, if he reverses that decree and says, okay, yeah, we'll go talk to the Russians, then that's a good start. Now, talking doesn't mean ceasefire. The West is demanding, you've got to institute an unconditional ceasefire. Russia's not going to do that. If they did that, they'd be fools. And in fact, you know, if Putin agreed to something like that, he probably ought to be ousted from office. But Putin's not going to do that. I just posted about a half hour ago at sonar21.com, at least it's supposed to have been posted, the speech that Vladimir Putin delivered on February 24th, 2022. If anybody listening to Nima and I talking right now have not read that speech, please go to sonar21.com and read it for yourselves. Because it answers the question. Vladimir Putin says we can only get into a ceasefire once we've dealt with the root causes of this conflict. And that speech, he lays out chapter and verse what are the root conflicts of that conflict. And until those are settled. And what boils down to, it's NATO. It's the expansion of NATO. It's the duplicity, the deviousness, the maliciousness of the West, the NATO. That's got to stop. Because the West desire to conquer and destroy Russia got to be put to an end. So Putin made this offer as a counter to cocaine-fueled party they had in Kiev with Starmer and Macron and Meretz and Tusk and Zelensky. I mean, and people say, what do you mean cocaine-fueled? They got a picture of these guys on the train, and you see basically the little bag that it had the cocaine, and you see the spoon that's used to put cocaine up one's nose, for God's sake. You know, a bunch of junkies that are leading the European Union. But anyway, they came out of this and demanded an immediate ceasefire for 30 days. And, you know, and if not, we're going to impose sanctions. And then, it's clear the Russians knew this was coming, that they had intelligence that this was going to happen. And they prepared a response. And Putin showed up. It was about 1:45 a.m. Moscow time. And said, look, we'll be happy to hold unconditional talks right now with Ukraine. But it doesn't mean we're going to stop fighting. It doesn't mean we're going to impose a ceasefire. But come and talk. We'll go back to where we had an agreement before that then Ukraine walked away from at the demands of the United States and Great Britain. So we'll see if they, you know, I don't think Zelensky will show up in Istanbul on Thursday, because to do so, he's got to reverse that decree.